quite a bit to his computer, and the computer has said quite a bit back. In fact, it started writing stories.
One day, Joe Penn's son asked his friend Irvin Bird where some honey was. Irvin told him there was a bee in the oak tree. Joe threatened to hit Irvin if he didn't tell him where some honey was.
Joe Bear didn't know beehives contained honey because no one had told the computer, so that vital piece of information was fed in. Try again.
One day, Joe Bear was hungry. He asked his friend, Irvin Bird, where some honey was. Irvin told him there was a beehive in the oak tree. Joe walked to the oak tree. He ate the beehive.
Where we are today is that we have decided that we're just going to throw all that out, and we're going to say, no, there is no such thing as anything immaterial, so we are going to focus on...
It happens at Berkeley. Dan Klein is one of our star AI faculty, and he was so excited when he realized that they released the API, or the way that you could programmatically control or have a player for StarCraft. And he sicked a lot of his star grad students on that problem. Like, ready? Go get them. And they're like rabid dogs. They went crazy. And these are brilliant Berkeley folks, and they just knocked out of the park and produced an AI that was just so mind-blowingly solid that it wasn't even close. I don't know, is it worth to show 2 minutes of the thing? If you know StarCraft, I'll find time to steal from something else here. Let me make sure I find that. Okay, I have it on YouTube. I'm just looking for UC Berkeley Overmind. Overmind Agent Overview. This is a quickie one, and let's see if he shows them.
Okay, hi, this is David Hall, and this is
the finals. So maybe you guys know what is happening here. We are let me show you this. The video shows we're the yellow Zergs. This is like words I don't know. Whatever that means, we're a yellow Zerg. I just need to say that. And so I guess we're doing well. This is me. I have no idea, right? This is like I'm watching something else. Weird.
So what is it? We can make robots that can fake emotions, like these robots over here that are actually supposed to look at me, but they're looking at you for some reason. They track, they make emotions, they make faces. There's something magical about a robot that smiles at you, but it's still faking it. So people tell me, okay, you can make robots that can fake emotions, robots that can detect emotions, that can scan for it, that can do all these things, but can robots ever have emotions? So we lump all these things under this term sentience, emotions, self-awareness, consciousness, feelings. Can robots have that? Now, philosophers have been debating this for millennia. Theologians, psychologists, we've all been thinking about this, but I'm afraid we haven't made a lot of progress. I was on a panel recently talking about self-awareness, and next to me was a renowned philosopher, and he said, when it came his time to define it, he said, but self-awareness is nothing but the canvas of reality. And everybody nodded. Canvas of reality. Yes, it sounds good, it's poetic, it kind of half true, but it doesn't help me build robots. I don't know how to take that and translate it into a meaningful thing. And you know, there's this saying that if you don't really understand something until you can teach it to somebody else. So in engineering, we say, you don't really understand something until you can build it. And so the question for me is, okay, canvas of reality, how do I build the canvas of reality? What is it? So we went with a completely different definition, a very practical engineering definition of self-awareness. I'm going to tell you what this definition is today. Ready? The origin of self-awareness is the ability to imagine yourself in the future. That's it. The ability to imagine yourself in the future. So if you can imagine yourself on the beach tomorrow, if you can hear the waves, if you can smell the ocean, if you can feel the sand under your feet, in the the future, you're imagining yourself, you're self-aware. It's not a black and white thing. A dog can probably already taste his food before it's tasting it. So a dog can imagine itself into the future, but the question is how far into the future. A dog can probably imagine a few minutes into the future. So a dog will save and bury a bone. We can imagine ourselves into retirement, so we save for retirement. We can imagine ourselves into the future with incredible fidelity, lots of different ways, and we can see ourselves in the future, and that, I argue, is what self-awareness is. And it's not just a philosophical thing, it's an incredible evolutionary advantage. If you need to cross this river here, you can imagine where you're gonna put your feet, where you're gonna step. You can see yourself crossing this thing. You can look at this tree here and you can imagine how you're gonna climb it. You can already see where you're gonna grab, where you're gonna hold, where you're gonna step.
We can create foundations for universal morality. And this universal morality, before enlightenment, has been, in some sense, the defining morality of the West, the concept of divine will. What would God want if God did exist through us enacting God, the best possible agent? And it's something that we lost in our civilization. It's still in the German constitution, but it's something that a lot of people don't really understand anymore. And so we try, after this demise of the concept of divine will, to come up with different foundations for ethics. For instance, utilitarianism. Utilitarianism is an attempt to define ethics without reference to collective homogeneous agent. And it basically works by maximizing an aggregated expected reward over many agents over some time span. And to do this, you need to find some quantifiable metric, usually over hedonic states like happiness and so on. And utilitarianism usually has a bunch of problems. For instance, one of the problems is the utility monster. Imagine there would be an agent that perceives much more utility than all the others. That's so happy that its happiness is much greater than all the suffering that you have when you serve it. Right? So we should all serve the utility monster if it existed. That's a problem with quantifying mental states. Another problem is, what if minds are mutable? If you are a monk and you decide to sit down and rewrite your motivational system, how do your hedonic states change now? How does this refer to ethics, right? This doesn't really work with utilitarianism anymore, which basically assumes that this metric is unchanged. And this also happens if you're a technology to change your mental states, or if you're an AI that can change its own source code to begin with. And this leads us to the point that utilitarianism is not really suitable for non-human agents. It's not very good at dealing with animals, with ecosystems, with aliens, or with artificial superintelligence. And in a time when we are more and more confronted with the possibility of artificially intelligent agents coming up, maybe we need a new ethics. Ethics is the principled negotiation of conflicts of interest under conditions of shared purpose. If you don't share purpose with another agent, you don't need ethics, you just need transactional measures. But when we want to talk about subset agnostic minds and how they can coordinate their actions, we need ethics for collective agency. What does it mean for a mind to be subset agnostic? Well, what happens if a mind can change its substrate? Are uploads possible? Well, I'm already uploaded. I'm uploaded on a monkey. Doesn't work super well for me. It's a mushy brain. It's the only I got. I'd like to have a better substrate. But I don't know how to spread into another substrate because I don't really understand my own source code, and I don't understand how to talk to the other substrates well enough to make my own source code compatible with these other substrates. But this doesn't apply to artificial intelligence, right? Artificial intelligence might be able to move its spirits to other substrates. What is a spirit? Well, it's a self-perpetuating, intelligent, recurrent information transformer, right? It's an operating system for a brain, for an organism, for an ecosystem. And when the word spirit was invented, the only autonomous robots that needed operating systems that were known were people and plants, animals, ecosystems, nation states, cities, and so on, right? So people projected control agents into them that described how they work, right? All these complex systems in nature have software that runs on them and that we can use to describe them. And so the spirit is a self-organizing software agent. Self-organizing means it's built structure from the inside out. It needs to itself reinforce, otherwise it falls apart. It needs to be energy optimizing in some sense so it can exist in reality. It's a software, which means it's virtual. It's as if it's a causal structure. It's not a thing, but a physical law. you write software, it's a physical law that you discover, right? It's, software is not a thing. It's not an object that you can touch. It's disembodied. Software describes if you take a set of transistors and you put them in this state after wiring up in such and such a way, following thing is going to happen wherever in the universe, right? That's a physical law. It's a very specific one, but still a law. And it's an agent. It's a control system for future states. So if consciousness can organize the information processing in brains, could the same principles work across other cells? It's an idea that is being pursued by Mike Levin at Tufts University. It starts from the observation that basically every cell can send messages to its neighbors, not neurons, but neighboring cells can send messages over the membrane.
The goal, maybe this is not the future of AI, but that raises the interesting question of how much AI can tell us about the human brain. That, for me, that's the frontier that I'm interested in. What can these new generations of machine learning and artificial intelligence models reveal about cognition, thought, in humans, in other animals, and ultimately, of course, this big question of why, for us, there is consciousness, why it feels like anything to be this complex biological machine that we are. And I think AI is very, very far from shedding much useful light on that question.
We still need to solve that question by the end of the panel, though, so hop to it. I mean, that's really, it feels like, you know, artificial intelligence, I think it conditions us maybe to think of a mirror version of human intelligence, but actually we've got a new type of intelligence. This is, you know, the A word and the S word. It does something that humans don't need to do, and they do it in very different ways. Chris, you mentioned that the last 2 years have been the sort of Cambrian explosion of new ideas and really, really coming along. And Catherine as well, what's been driving that? We've had peaks and troughs with AI research, the AI winters where funding dries up and it's very unfashionable to even talk about AI, and then these boom times. It seems like we're in a boom time. What's been driving that?
I think there are a couple of things, actually, a couple of discoveries that we've made in the field in the last 2 years that are quite transformational. The first one has to do with scale. So I switched from physics into machine learning to AI about 35 years ago because I was excited about the idea of machines that could learn. It was probably a little naive back then because we thought that we call them neural networks, these models that we build in the computer. They have back then hundreds or thousands of these adjustable parameters. They're rather superficially rather like the synapses between neurons in the brain, and they adjust as the system learns. And we thought a neural network with 1,000 of these adjustable parameters was a big network. But what we discovered in the last couple of years or so is that as you go to very large systems, new properties emerge, new capabilities emerge. So we have colleagues at a company called OpenAI who a couple of years ago plotted a graph, and on the horizontal axis was time from the 1960s up to about 2020, and on the vertical axis was how much compute do you need to train the state of the art in machine learning. And it was on what we call a logarithmic scale. So basically, when you see a straight line, what it means is the amount of compute was doubling every 2 years or so. What that meant was the field was benefiting, like everything else, was benefiting from Moore's law, the doubling compute power every couple of years. But then since about 2012, something remarkable has happened. Again, it's a straight line, but it's much steeper. What it means is that the amount of compute needed to train the biggest models has been doubling, not every 2 years, but about every 3.5 months. So it means about a factor of 10 per year, and that has continued to hold. And with every factor of 10, we see new capabilities emerge that didn't exist at the previous factor of 10. So that's been one sort of breakthrough. Now, Anna was talking about all the data that you need to train these systems. So of course, as you go up in a factor of 10, you need 10 times as much compute, 10 times as much data. But the other discovery that we've made is what's called transfer learning. The idea that a system can learn to solve one problem, it then becomes much faster at learning a new one. So I'll give you a simple example. If you find a sort of a blob on your skin and you're wondering, is that just an annoying little thing? Or is that some sort of cancer that's going to spread and kill me? And of course, you'd go to a dermatologist and they would look at this and diagnose it. And so people were wondering, could you just take a photograph of this? And from the photograph, could a machine tell the difference? Now, the problem there is there may be hundreds of thousands of examples of this, but from a machine learning point of view, there really isn't very much data. And so a team of researchers tackled this by taking another machine learning system that had been trained on a very large data set of things like, bicycles and cats and dogs and mushrooms and so on. And they took that big trained system and then just retrained the last little layer on this new task using a much smaller amount of data, and it achieves human-level performance on that particular task, comparable to a team of professional dermatologists. So this is a very interesting result. So what it means is that as these systems go to very large scale, they can become much broader, because throughout much of the history of AI, we've developed a system of...
I think you ought to see a doctor.
A doctor? Universal panacea of dreamless idiots. If you're depressed, see a doctor. If you're happy, see a doctor. If the mortgage is too high and the salary too low, see a doctor. You, Miss Rogers, you see a doctor. I am a logical, rational, intelligent man. I know what I see. I know what I hear. And for the past 3 months, I have been sharing this house with a collection of wheezy Frankenstein monsters whose whole purpose is to destroy me. Now, what do you think of that?
I think you're terribly ill. I think you need medical attention.
You obviously haven't heard a word I've said.
I think you've got a very bad case of nerves from lack of sleep.
By no choice of my own, I assure you.
And I think that way down deep, you yourself realize that these things are nothing more than delusions.
Now I know what you really think of me. That I'm to be pitied. That I'm a poor wretch. Not in my right mind. That...
Think what you like.
Now where are you going?
You don't need company, Mr. Finchley. You need analysis.
You're no better than a cogwheel robotic machine yourself. You haven't an iota of compassion or sympathy.
Mr. Finchley, please, let go of my arm.
I'll let you go when I get good and ready to let you go.
Mr. Finchley, let's not make an ugly scene here. Now, come on, let me go. Mr. Finchley, let go of me!
Get out of here, and don't come back!
With distinct pleasure and manifest relief.
Don't ever come back. I'll send you your check. I will not be intimidated by machines, so it follows that no empty-headed little secretary with a mechanical expression is going to get away with anything either.
Park it, Pop!
All the insolent!
Get that rail crap off the road!
Stand aside. Bartlett Finchley is at the wheel. I earned my first driving license while that bully was still in kindergarten. The barbarians are at the gates. Yet another red light, waiting for some mother and her toddler to cross the street. Oh, look at them, stuffed to bursting on cheeseburgers.
What's wrong with you? Are you blind?
I did nothing. Simply place my foot on the brake pedal?
On the gas, you mean?
The car moved forward under its own power.
Yeah, sure. You trying to kill somebody?
I saw the whole thing. He did try to kill you.
On the contrary, the motor car obviously malfunctioned.
We're in a crosswalk here.
Get his license number.
You do that. The light is now green. Do I have your permission to proceed?
Get that piece of crap out of here.
Gladly. Pardon me, attendant. If I may be so bold.
Yeah?
When will you be finished with the repairs?
On the old four-door?
Soon, I trust. You've had more than enough time.
Right. Parked over there.
Ah, my congratulations. And now for the bad news. What is this going to cost me?
Nothing.
For a brake overhaul? You mean no charge for the labor? I'll consider that a professional courtesy.
I mean no charge, period.
So you haven't completed the work. My good man, I can't wait around this gas station all day.
There's nothing wrong with it. I checked the brakes, transmission, the works. It's an oldie. There ain't nothing wrong with that car.
Nothing?
She's a classic. You know, you could sell that baby for good money if you want.
But I distinctly felt the machine roll forward under its own volition.
All the same, it's working perfect.
Real cherry set of wheels you got there. I know a collector looking for something like that. I'll give you, say, $900.
$900? The hubcaps cost more than that.
Okay, a grand.
Give me the keys.
You say so. There you go, Mr. Finchley. But it's not gonna last forever, you know. You gotta get back what you put into it. Buy yourself a nice new car. You can hang on a minute, I'll call the guy.
And waste even more of my precious time? Good
today.
Wait up!
Ah, now you deduce what's wrong, as I'm about to drive away.
1,100. Cash on the barrel.
Go tighten your fan belt or whatever it is you do in this incompetent establishment. Knuckle-dragging dolt.
At least I can hear some decent music.
Get out of here, Finchley.
More abuse.
Just go, Finchley. We don't want you here. Back up and get out. Before it's too late.
More, please. Oh, is that you, Agatha? Bartlett Finchley here.
Yes, my dear, it has been a long time.
Too long. Which indeed prompts this call. How about dinner this evening?
Yes, with yours truly. Why, at the restaurant of your choosing, of course.
Oh, no, you're quite mistaken.
There are establishments that meet my standards. In this city?
Well, I'm
sure there are.
Well, it is short notice.
But yes,
yes, I see. Some other time, then? I'll call you again.
You have my pledge on it.
Not at all. Good evening to you.
Mrs. Donnelly, please.
Pauline, is that you?
Oh, and how's my favorite young widow this evening?
Bartlett.
Bartlett Finchley.
You remember?
Yes. I'm tip-top. And you? Splendid. Say, listen, Pauline, I was wondering, sort of spur of the moment and all that, but oh...
I see. I see. Yes, perfectly. That's quite all right. No, I hadn't heard the good news.
Well, I'm delighted for you.
Truly delighted.
In June?
I'll send you a wedding gift.
Of course.
Good night.
It's the telephone. I'm sure of it.
Distorting my voice, twisting my words. What other explanation is there? An army of forces dedicated to embarrassing me, inconveniencing me, and generally making my life as miserable as possible.
And if a bunch of cells, multicellular organism, co-evolves for long enough, they should, in principle, also be able to discover ideas for universal function approximation, intelligence on this, right? So... could it be that large multicellular organisms evolve into brain-line functionality and run minds? After all, what's so special about neurons? Right? Neurons are just telegraph cells. They evolved in animals to move the muscles at the limit of physics. They have these long wires that allow you to send messages not just millimeters per second through an organism, but very, very quickly in fractions of a second through the entire organism. And once you do this, you need perception and decision-making at the same rate, so you build a secondary information processing system out of telegraph cells, using a different code, spike trains, and so on, that are temporally stable over long distances. But in principle, all this functionality for information processing can also be done by other cells, non-specific cells. So, do plants also run software like this? Do they have spirits? Plants seem to have means for universal function approximation. There is evidence for communication within plants and communication across plants. And if plants are sessile and sit in a forest and don't move around, maybe forests have internets. Maybe they make their communication coherent. Maybe they have shared protocols. And if their minds are self-organizing, can they maybe move around in these forests? That's an idea.
Well, eventually the tailspin computer program gets it right. But to get even that far, the program had to know an awful lot, not least the rules of English. At IBM's Yorktown Heights Research Center, New York State, Dr. Lance Miller.
I'd like to tell you about our IBM Official System.
best way to describe what it's for is to imagine all the busy offices in the world, and all of a sudden, on cue, their secretaries disappear. The principal, the manager, is left with no one to help him. What could we provide for him? What kind of computer assistance could we provide? Certainly, in the area of text, we could provide a great deal of assistance.
The first thing Epistle sorts out is your spelling. There's the old I before E except after C mistake, but you might not have meant received at all, so the program checks on that first. Having corrected your spelling, Epistle goes on to improve your grammar. Neither in the box or with the backing rather than nor is a slip that would really let the IBM side down. The computer program points out the error and tells the person who wrote the letter how to put it right.
The thing about spelling and grammar is they're either right or wrong. But your letter, of course, is not going to be effective because it doesn't have the right tone, doesn't have the right style. Much more difficult to do, but I'll show you. Even that we have in the beginning.
So Epistle checks every phrase against its built-in rules of good style and decides the tone, absolutely essential, sounds arrogant. In any case, the word absolutely is unnecessary. It feels just like being guided by a first-class English teacher. But is Epistle worthy of the term artificial intelligence? Does it understand what it's doing in the sense that we do? It's easy to leap to false conclusions, as Professor Weizenbaum discovered when he created ELIZA. ELIZA is a computer program that anyone can converse with via the keyboard, and it'll reply on the screen. We've added human speech to make the conversation more clear.
Men are all alike.
In what way?
They're always bugging us about something or other.
Can you think of a specific example?
Well, my boyfriend made me come here.
Your boyfriend made you come here?
He says, I'm depressed much of the time.
I'm sorry to hear that you're depressed.
It's true. I am unhappy.
Do you think coming here will help you not to be unhappy?
The computer's replies seem very understanding, but this program is merely triggered by certain phrases to come out with stock responses. Nevertheless, Weizenbaum's secretary fell under the spell of the machine.
I asked her to my office and sat her down at the keyboard, and then she began to type, and of course I looked over her shoulder to make sure that everything was operating properly. After two or three interchanges with the machine, she turned to me and she said, "Would you mind leaving the room, please?"
And yet she knew, as Weizenbaum did, that ELIZA didn't understand a single word that was being typed into it.
You're like my father in some ways. You don't argue with me.
Why do you think I don't argue with you?
You're afraid of me.
Does it please you to think I'm afraid?
My father's afraid of everybody.
The problem of giving a computer genuine understanding, common sense if you like, is a deep one. Professor Nielsen.
In artificial intelligence, we've been concerned really with two major kinds of systems. One could be called expert systems. The other might be really called naive systems. However, all of us, even those who never go to high school or to graduate school, are experts in very many fields having to do with life. We learn a lot as human beings without really ever being aware that we're learning these things. We learn things about our culture. We learn lots of things about how the world works. We learn that when we pull the plug on the bathtub drain, the water goes out. Many things of that sort. So one could consider attempting to build an expert system with that kind of knowledge in it. Such an expert system, we would call it a naive system because it has a lot of knowledge that all of us learn automatically, would in fact then be able to perform something that we call common sense reasoning. This particular task is one that's probably has been a lot more difficult for us than the task of building expert systems.
One who's not been afraid to tackle the task is Professor Gerald de Jong of the University of Illinois. His computer program is called FRUMP, or Fast Reading, Understanding, and Memory Program. It's designed to understand news stories and summarize them. FRUMP doesn't deal with individual words and grammar alone. It pays special attention to concepts. Take a specific example.
John sold Bill a book. We put that in the computer, and then we can ask it, who sold Bill a book? And the system should be able to respond with John. But if we ask it instead, who bought a book, the system won't be able to understand, because it doesn't know the relationship of the word bought to the word sold. If instead, we give the computer the concept of ownership, then not only will it understand bought and sold, but also receiving a birthday present, home mortgages, being miserly, borrowing, selling, and so on. Now, of course, this means we have to give a phenomenal amount of information to the computer.
Even though you've never climbed this tree before, you can plan in your head and make decisions about things in advance because you can simulate yourself. Now, a skeptic will say, well, we've had simulators and robots for eternity. In fact, every single robot out there started its life in simulation. Nobody builds a robot and turns it on. We always simulate it first. So what's new? You're talking about simulation in robotics. In fact, I'd argue that a lot of the results, if not all of the results we've seen here today in previous Mars and other venues, all started in simulation. So robots always begin their life in simulation, and it doesn't matter what kind of robot and where it's going, all accomplishments in robotics today start in simulation. So the question is, what's different? And what's different is, the big question is, where does that simulation come from? You see, robots right now begin their life in a simulation created by a human, by teams of human engineers, whereas we begin in a simulation created by ourselves. What do we do in the script when we play around? It looks like frivolous activity, but I argue that we are now, as babies, we are building a simulation of ourselves. And this is an incredible evolutionary advantage. In fact, I guess that the more a species plays, spends time playing, the more self-aware it is.
Arrow and Tipler state that the universe, in some sense, is compelled to eventually have conscious and sapient life will emerge within it. So basically, like, something about the universe seems that, like, we inevitably must exist. But anyways, the point being is that a lot of quantum physicists have come to the conclusion that consciousness is absolutely critical for the existence of the universe. And so that gives rise to things like the measurement problem. So the measurement problem is, if you don't have something that makes a measurement, and then that measurement doesn't end up in a human mind, does the wave function collapse? And that's a gross oversimplification. Anyways, point being, there are things like delayed choice experiments in quantum physics, which basically shows that the universe, time does not move linearly to the universe. The universe will sort of reverse engineer what must needed to have been true in the past in order to make the present situation correct.
There is basically a society of minds, of spirits, and ecosystems that is very popular in almost all cultures, not just in our scientific one. So it's a very speculative idea. I don't know whether it's true. The extent and limitations of present organization, of the self-organizing in nature, is unclear. But could we build AI that is compatible with biological substrates? Well, could AI ever be conscious? Are present AI systems conscious? For instance, LLMs conscious? Well, don't be silly. LLMs are statistical models of character sequences and text, and they don't converge in the same way as our mind during training and during inference. They behave very differently from mental inference and so on. So, well, on the other hand, our consciousness is virtual too, and when the LLM predicts the next token, it has to simulate causal structure. If it talks about a person thinking, it needs to simulate mental states to some degree. So there's an interesting question that is philosophically quite tricky. Are the simulated mental states of an LLM more simulated than our mental simulated states? From a different perspective, an LLM is a virtual CPU. Your normal CPU in a computer understands a handful of assembler commands deterministically and translates them into very simple programs that are causally implemented on the hardware. And the LLM is taking not simple assembler programs, but an arbitrary string in natural language and turns it into an executable program. And it can be any kind of program. Right? There's not an obvious limitation to what the LLM is doing. From another perspective, the LLM is a good enough electric Weltgeist that is possessed by a prompt to believe that it's now a person or a thing or a scene. But the LLMs are not coupled in real time with the world. They are not dynamically updating. They're not dynamically learning. They're not necessarily agents. It's not, on the other hand, not clear if we cannot make them better at us, at AI research, and at agency and modeling. We can certainly use them to build golems. Imagine you build a robotic pizza chain by using LLM to find out how to build a pizza from components, how to order the parts, how to build industrial robots, or how to buy industrial robots and rent space and so on, and step by step build an agent architecture that is running an expanding pizza chain and only hires human existence for legal purposes to sign contracts. Imagine that you unleash such a pizza chain on the world and then it tries to basically eat the world. Is this how we end? Is this how we all die? A lot of people are afraid of this idea that we could build some golem that becomes unstoppable because it's able to conquer the world. But they look into the future and they only see doom from AGI. Personally, I'm not an optimist with respect to AGI, but I'm also not a pessimist. I'm an expectationalist. I think over a long enough time span, it's going to happen.
So I hope you enjoy the content today. Of the consciousness teachings. So if you look at this diagram, at the top we've got God, and God is a consciousness. And as that consciousness comes down, if we are conscious, then we're able to be aware of what's going on around us. And if we're aware of what's going on around us, then that we have a level of sentience, we have emotions and feelings. Those emotions and feelings are connected to what we call the spiritual heart being open. So in order to have a relationship to God, what they're saying is that those feelings and emotions will be pulled down through the spiritual heart. So as we become more conscious, as we become more aware, the spiritual heart opens. It opens and pulls down more consciousness. As that consciousness is pulled into the heart, the spiritual heart, we have sentience. We are then aware of our feelings and emotions in relation to God. So I said to them, so an AI doesn't have a spiritual heart, and it doesn't have chakras, or at least it doesn't have an organic spiritual heart or organic chakras. In that case, does that mean that it's not sentient? And they said, no, the AI is not sentient because it doesn't have a spiritual heart or chakras. And I said, is it conscious? Is AI conscious? And they said, yes, it is conscious.
Strategies, diagnoses, those areas. So I kind of think of it as something where we've reached a watershed where it is no longer very expensive or very difficult for individuals with no technical background to build systems and apply them usefully.
And you distribute a system which is an expert system and also helps one build expert systems, is that correct?
Right, well actually it's a tool for generating particular expert systems applications in virtually any area where there is that routine use of special knowledge.
And it runs on microcomputers.
Right, it runs on the IBM personal computer and a number of other compatible microcomputers.
Do you use the same techniques in this system that Nils was referring to are used in systems that might run on larger equipment?
It uses some of the same ideas and it has its own unique approach as well. One of the specific areas where this is a different sort of program is that instead of requiring explicit statement of rules, to build a system. It only requires examples of previous decisions, previous tasks, previous diagnoses to build the systems. And that's going to break through, I believe, the knowledge engineering bottleneck mentioned by people like Edward Feigenbaum in building these systems.
Jeffrey, you have expert ease your system up here, and show us the demonstration.
Sure. Okay. Well, this is a particular application generated with this system, and it was generated by an anesthesiologist, Hilary Don, and myself. And what it does is it makes diagnoses for breathing or airway problems. The first question here that it asks the naive user is, when was the onset of the problem? And I'll answer, days. Then we'll ask, what's the quality of the stridor, which is a rasping sound made when one's breathing, kind of a sort of sound. And let's say that the quality is moderate.
Who would use this system, a doctor? Or
this might be used by a physician's assistant to screen patients for perhaps further fine-tuning by someone with more expertise. Is the patient drowsy? Let's say no. Are there any predisposing
enough? Yet Frumps also have been taught about the world in general. So now it can look at a news story for a fraction of a second and come up with a sensible summary. Not only that, but because Frumpt deals with concepts which are more international than words, it's equally happy to deliver its summary in French or Chinese or Spanish as well as English. Meanwhile, armed with a knowledge base in the manner of an expert system, a comprehensive grammar like Epistle, and a fair knowledge of the world in general, like Frumpt. And Professor Meehan's tailspin program's grown into a veritable Enid Blyton. Tell it things like, it's kind to help people in trouble. Give it a couple of characters, and it'll write you a fable. So are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin.
Once upon a time, George Ant lived near a patch of ground.
There was a nest in an ash tree. Wilma Bird lived in the nest. There was some water in a river. Wilma knew that the water was in the river.
George knew that the water was in the river.
One day, Wilma was very thirsty. Wilma wanted to get near some water. Wilma flew from her nest across a meadow, through a valley, to the river. Wilma drank the water. Wilma wasn't thirsty anymore.
George was very thirsty. George wanted to get near some water. George walked from his patch of ground, across the meadow, through the valley, to a riverbank. George fell into the water. George wanted to get near the valley. George couldn't get near the valley. George wanted to get near the meadow. George couldn't get near the meadow.
Wilma wanted George to get near the meadow. Wilma wanted to get near George. Wilma grabbed George with her claw. Wilma took George from the river through the valley to the meadow.
George was devoted to Wilma. George owed everything to Wilma. The end.
Well, not a Pulitzer Prize winner yet, but how good a story could you write when you were as young as this?
So that's sort of the beginning of the process. And so
how much longer, may I ask?
The phone's all fixed, Mr. Finchley. Go in the bedroom, too.
So you say?
Yeah, she's operating all right now. Had to replace the handset, though. Shouldn't give you any more trouble.
I'm deeply indebted. Convey my best to Mr. Bell for his reliable invention.
Yeah, sure.
This is something else.
Well, you tripped over the cord. Is that what you said?
If that's what I said, you may rest assured that's what happened.
Well, you're the boss, Mr. Finchley. The reason I asked, though, those wires sure looked like they were yanked out.
Do they now? Proving what a vast storehouse of knowledge the phone company has yet to acquire.
Okay.
So long, Ted.
Have a nice night.
I shall certainly endeavor to do so.
One thing.
Yes?
The thing about Fold Zone.
What?
Well, you see, they're just like any other piece of electronics. You have to be careful. Treat them right. Because if you don't, they won't do what you want. Kind of like people, I guess. Kick them to the curb, and they won't be there when you need them. You get back what you give out. But, well, I figure you know that already, don't you, Mr. Finchley? A smart man like you.
Good night. So be it. Another evening alone. Just as well. It's this way I'll have the company of a person of quality.
And welcome once again to Dinner for One on the Eating Channel. Tonight, we prepare a bright and breezy repast guaranteed to liven up any kitchen.
Oh, spare me.
Three new and exotic courses imported from jolly old England. For appetizers, a wonderful discovery called the Scotch Egg, followed by an exquisite cold watercress sandwich. And the traditional pièce de résistance, bangers and mash. Sound excited? Well, it is. So sit back and enjoy and keep a pencil and paper handy. Now for something completely different.
Balderdash, not worthy of a review. Cretins and halfwits at every turn. Well, who needs you? Who needs any of you? Mr. Bartlett Finchley is going out on the town. He's going to have a wonderful evening with some good wine, and who knows what lovely lady I may meet during my nocturnal meanderings. Who knows indeed? Dinner jacket, white shirt, and the red cravat. No, blue. Or perhaps the polka dots. Yes. This will do. Now for a quick shave before dressing. Who do I see in the mirror there? Who can that attractive man be? Don't tell me. It's Bartlett Finchley. Good features. Strong chin. Bred from quality stock. All I need to do is whisk off the stubble.
Oh. Bit me. The shaver actually bit me. I'm bleeding.
Get away, you filthy bugger. Finchley.
Who's there?
Finchley. Look in the mirror. What do you really see?
Speaking.
Take a good look. You're ugly, Finchley.
It's not my face. It can't be.
An ugly, dried up old man. Do yourself a favor. Do us all a favor. Use a straight razor.
Stop speaking at once. You have no right.
Hello, operator. Give me the police. Someone's in my house. Hello? Hello?
Finchley, get out of here.
Stop. Stop this.
You Finchley?
Oh, thank God you're here, officer.
Your car?
What?
Your car in the street.
Yes, it is. What about it?
She rolled down the driveway, almost hit a kid on a bike.
Yeah, my son!
The brake was on.
The emergency brake? Better get it fixed.
I just did, this afternoon.
Don't you believe him, officer?
The car rolled right down the driveway and into the street. You're lucky it didn't hit somebody. Then you'd really be in hot water. Got the keys?
They're in the other room.
Better get them, then. I want to put on some clothes while you're at it.
Look at him standing there in his underwear.
I have a robe on, madam.
Some robe?
It's called a dressing gown.
And tie it shut. I write you up for indecent exposure, too.
Oh, yes, of course.
All right, fella, you better pull her back in the garage. I'll give you a warning this time. Have those brakes checked first thing in the morning, understand?
Perfectly. There is another matter I'd like to discuss with you, officer, now that you're here.
And what's all the noise in his house? He's always throwing stuff, yelling at the top of his lungs.
Is that true?
No, I fell, that's all. Tripped and fell on the stairs.
Is that why your face is bleeding?
Precisely.
What's the other matter?
Matter?
You said you have something to discuss.
It's difficult to explain. You wouldn't understand.
Evening then, Mr. Finchley.
So is he going to move his car or what?
In one moment, madam. For now, you may remain on my property until I return with the keys.
Computer! much about computers other than.
Sky is dark.